Hello, everybody. That's a real live cowboy singing in the studio here on Eat to the Beat. We're on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm Sarah Obritis. We've been sponsored by TechServe, fabulous computer shop on 23rd Street and also online. Thank you, TechServe, for making it possible for us to broadcast out here from Bushwick, Brooklyn. And Brian Kenny here. Is with me here from Hearst Ranch. Sorry we couldn't mention that Hearst is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Well, anyway, thanks for joining in, Brian, as our guest musician and co-host.
It's a distinct honor to be here, Sarah.
Thank you very much. And fittingly, we have as our guest, our first call-in guest, Dr. Jana Fallon, who's a professor of music education at Kansas State, and an expert in cowboy music, and she's from Manhattan, Kansas, the Little Apple. Welcome,
Sarah.
Jana. Thanks
Thank
for coming
you.
In.
I'm just delighted to be with you and with Brian.
Oh, yeah.
Dynamite. Well, you studied a time, or you still study, a time when cattle drives and cowboy culture ruled this land. Its music was collected by the likes of Allen and John Lomax.
That's true.
Celebrated in folklore. And inspired artists like Pete Seeger, Gene Autry, not in this order, of course, Willie Nelson, the Guthries, I'm sure, and a guy named Michael Martin Murphy, who I'm sure you'll reference. So I guess I'd like to start with, I'm going to give you a sort of historical trajectory, and you tell me if I got it right and where you want to jump in.
All righty.
Okay, we have the Irish ballads that... poured into folk songs. We have real cowboy music from the late 1800s and early 1900s. We have cowboy music Hollywood style, like the singing cowboys, Roy Rogers. We have country music, then western music, then 1960s folk music, then country western music.
So go ahead.
Jump right in, Jana.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Irish ballads because one of the songs that we all know is Streets of Laredo, and it actually started as an Irish ballad that was called Bard of Armagh, and the cowboys knew the tune, and it had come over with immigrants, and they just added new words, which is the way a lot of folk music happens. They'll take a tune and then add new words, and that's what happened with Streets of Laredo. And a lot of contemporary artists still perform that piece. And it was one of the songs that the cowboys would have sung on the trail drives.
Right on. And you were born and raised in Texas.
I was.
You're obviously in Kansas right now.
I am.
Two cattle country states,
it is.
If you will.
I grew up on one end of the Chisholm Trail, I say, and I'm on the other end now, and I've been in Kansas 22 years. I grew up in an area that had a lot of cattle and farms and horses, and I was always told that we were near the Chisholm Trail, and it's at the bottom of my county, Coleman County, and there's this little town called Trickham, Texas. And the story was, and it's true, that the cowboys would come through on their way on the drives and would buy whiskey at the little store there, and the man would water down their whiskey. And so it got, be careful, he'll trick you, that kind of stuff. And so it became known as Trickham, Texas. And the name stuck, and that's really the name, the honest-to-gosh name of this little town, and now it's hardly anything left. But there's a letter from a cowboy that said that the grass was as tall as a man's leg on horseback, and that's how tall the grass was, so it was a great place to feed cattle. But the problem was it wasn't the real Chisholm Trail, and this is kind of interesting. The man's name that had the was having the cattle fed at that place was named John Chisholm, Chisholm, and it wasn't the Jesse Chisholm that the trail was named after, who was an Indian in Oklahoma that had a store in Duncan, Oklahoma. But anyway, I was always told, hey, we were on the Chisholm Trail, but it was the wrong Chisholm Trail.
Yeah.
But they did raise cattle, and they did trail them up, and most of John Chisholm's cattle went up to New Mexico or onto the northern route of sometimes the Goodnight Loving Trail. But the story went that there were thousands of cattle that were herded down the main street of Coleman, Texas during that historic time.
So before and we jump right into Jana, one moment, what you call authentic cowboy music, I mean, that's what you've studied, that's what you're an expert in. Before we get to that history, what can you tell me what you think your old stomping grounds in Texas and on the Chisholm Trail, what's the modern day cowboy music scene like, and is there one?
Yeah, there is, and I think almost everybody in Texas listens to contemporary Western music and country music, and a lot of the people of the Willie Nelsons that have come along have been so popular, really have roots stuck in this tradition of cowboy music that started with the Cowboys on the Trail. The thing that interests me so much is that they really did sing as part of their work, and I'm sure we'll get into that during our conversation.
Absolutely. So we'll take a break and come back to find out just how these cowboys incorporated music
Wonderful.
Into their passion and profession. All right, take
Thanks,
care.
Sarah.
Hold on one sec.
As I walked out in the streets of Laredo, as I walked out in Laredo one day,
wow, you just pulled that out of your
I did.
Hat, Brian. Kudos to you, Brian Kenny. From Hearst Ranch, a real rancher, singing beautiful music. So we're also picking up with Dr. Jana Fallon, music professor from Kansas State. And so, Jana, tell me you were pretty adamant about what you were going to talk about and what your expertise is in authentic cowboy music.
That's
so you
right.
want to just tell us, give us the basics. What is that?
There's a lot of cowboy history with music, and I've always been kind of interested in it because I love folk music, but I love folk art. But when I really started studying it, I realized that the cowboys used music as part of their work. They would sing to the cattle to kind of get them moving in the mornings, and they would sing to them along the day, and of course they entertain themselves, kind of like we put on the radio to listen. They'd sing during the day. And then at night, they'd sing to the cattle when they were bedded down to keep them calm and to keep them from stampeding. Because the last thing they wanted was a stampede. They would sometimes run for 4 hours if they got to running, and it'd run off the fat, and they wanted them to be fat when they got up
Sure.
to Abilene, Kansas, where the railhead was, and so that they could make more money.
I liken this, Jana, to the pretty symphonies that they play at the airports to calm us, us crazy cows corralling through the airports.
They corral us,
right?
That may be true.
I heard Burt Bacharach today. I didn't hear a pretty symphony.
Oh, geez. Well, anyway, they were going for the same effect. So where were we? Did I interrupt you? Pick
no,
up where
no,
we were?
You did fine. But I went to the University of Texas. I have had two Big 12 research grants, and I visited UT in Austin and hung out at their history museum, and there's a lot of John Lomax original material there. And
Texas, isn't he?
He was. And I guess my greatest find was Canción from the border area of Texas, and it was called Va a Kansas. And it's a ballad that's in Spanish about cowboys driving cattle up to Kansas from Texas, and that when they go back through San Antonio, they buy big white hats. And that's probably my most interesting historic find. But
and do you
I've
collect
a lot.
Lot of this music, Jana? You have vinyl, or do you have?
I have lots of collections. All of its CDs that I have. I shouldn't say that. When people find out I'm interested in it, I have been given so many things. people that their daddy had loved country music, and they'll give me his record collection and that kind of stuff. So I'm hoping that Kansas State can figure out a way to be kind of a repository of authentic old stuff and of new, just like Brian is sitting there playing for you. There are a lot of people who still compose and sing in this genre, and I'd like to be able for them to have a place to put their music.
Absolutely. We're going to get back to Kansas State in a second, but Brian, you have a question?
I had a question for you, Janet. Could you talk a little bit about the White Hats coming back from, did you say coming back from Abilene? That really struck a note with
me. Who knows why they wanted to come through and buy white hats, but that's what this Mexican song says, that the cowboys on their way back to South Texas stopped in San Antonio and bought big white hats.
Maybe it's because they were done working.
Maybe so. I don't know. Probably they love the look of them. You know,
well,
they were pretty.
That's a sharp way to come back from a ride.
5 gallon bucket hats. Is that what we're talking about?
I had a question for you too. I mean, it's such an honor to talk to somebody that's steeped in the tradition.
Mm-hmm. You're very kind.
Well, I mean, I'm a huge and avowed fan of Bob Wills. And listening to songs, I mean, there are a lot of Bob Wills songs that evoke the classic kind of cowboy tradition, but like Dusty Skies, is that a traditional type song, or where did these things come from? Was that a popularization move that they made,
or when was Ben singing, or like what year are we talking
about? Bob Wills was singing in the
30s, 20s, 30s,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It would have been a popularization, and he was a wonderful dance guy, you know, they'd play, Bob Wills played all over, up in here too, in Kansas.
So was he someone that was kind of like working in that Hollywood sort of pomp and circumstance?
It's part of a popular tradition. Mm-hmm. What happened was, people loved reading about the cowboys. They had those dime novels. The Virginian was one of the most best-selling novels, and people would just buy anything. They wanted magazine articles about the trail drives and about the cowboys. And Hollywood and other publishers and artists realized, hey, people love this stuff and it'll sell. Mm-hmm. So Hollywood got involved with it, and they they did just partial truths. Sarah, the other day, I told you they had Gene Autry in his silk shirts and beautiful kerchiefs, you know, which would not have been how the cowboy was dressed. And he probably would not have had a guitar, and all of them had guitars.
Right.
But it was too big. They couldn't carry a guitar, but they had harmonicas and probably might have been a fiddle.
Or a mandolin, maybe.
And a mandolin that they might have carried in the chuck wagon.
And this is back... Mm-hmm.
Sometimes banjos. Anyway, it just developed because people loved it. They loved to hear about it. And the cowboy was a romantic figure and brave, and the American people just loved it in the 1860s to 80s, around in there. And so people realized, hey, if we publish, if we do art, if we write music, the people are going to buy it. Mm-hmm. And it's not just Americans. That's been interesting to me. Germans, there's Europeans love stuff about cowboys and cowboy music.
And they have their own versions, obviously.
I have a Swedish version of Cotton Eye Joe. You know, it's funny how it jumps. These songs jump to other countries and other cultures. Go ahead.
I was going to say that I had personal experience with this playing country music in Germany and Belgium, and it was like if you went over there and you had a cowboy hat and you could play Hank Williams, you never had to buy a meal or a drink.
Yeah.
And they loved it. It was so evocative.
That's what they said about Tex Ritter when he went from Texas, Austin, Texas, to New York. That's John Ritter's daddy.
Right.
And he could sing Rye Whiskey, Rye Whiskey. And they said, as long as you can sing that song, you'll never go hungry, because somebody will always be willing to give you money to sing that song. And there's something very, I think it has to do with there's a simplicity of it, and it, there's a poignancy a lot, and people are drawn in to the, and there's a loveliness about the melodies. Red River Valley, what a beautiful melody. Very simple and lovely.
And for a lot of these guys, there are memories of spending time out in the field, farming. You know, there's a sort
sure.
of, there's a civilized, calm way of life that they're celebrating. Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a break and have
Brian
play
some music. Wonderful. And then we'll talk more.
Please.
In the twilight's glow, I see them. Blue eyes crying in the rain. When we kissed goodbye and parted, I knew we'd never meet again. Love is like a dying ember, and only memories remain. In the land that knows no parting, blue eyes crying in the rain.
Everybody, this is Sarah here on Eat to the Beat with Brian Kenny. Thank you, Brian. That was
Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
Yeah.
Dynamite, and that's Dr. Jana Fallon on the other line. So let's talk about K-State, Kansas State, that is, and academic life. And you can please tell us about what a typical Dr. Jana Fallon class is like, what your students are like, what your courses are like. And
I work with people who are going to be teachers, and this summer I've got a really neat little class of gals who are going to be elementary teachers, and I work with them on how to use music to teach other subjects. That's how I do elementary. Then I have music majors, and they are training to be real music teachers, how to bring music to children. And I think it's very important because we're learning so much about the brain and how it functions and what music does to help the brain learn. So I'm thankful that I'm able to help teachers. I think it's such an important part of our society, and very difficult to be a good teacher, and yet so important.
Absolutely.
So I train teachers all the time, and I work with graduate people who are coming back for graduate degrees. And I love K-State, Sarah. Have you been? Have you been to Manhattan?
No, I haven't.
I know you have friends here.
Yeah, I sure do.
We're the oldest land-grant college in the nation.
That's right. 1863, is it?
That's right. And we were signed in to law by President Lincoln. He started the land-grant movement, which was to, it was called the Morrill, M-O-R-R, I think I-L-L, Act, and it was to bring education to the people. And mm-hmm. I love that concept, and we're still that way here at K-State. We bring education to people. And, you know, back when, in the 1860s, if you weren't wealthy, you couldn't have gone to school. So it makes me really happy to say that I'm part of a land-grant college.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that you're a music teacher, it's like a science teacher. There are a few good ones, few and far between, and music is such a but some people shy away from it because it could be a tech, or the education of music could be like overly technical, or
yeah,
perhaps,
I've been told they can't do it, and I always say, man, what a stupid person that told you that, because if anybody can learn to sing, and research has been done so often on this, they don't even replicate it anymore, but if you don't have a physical disability, like a hearing loss or some problem with vocal mechanism, you can learn to sing. And, of course, it's a lot easier when you're four or three than when you're 20-something, and a lot of people told you don't sing. Right. So,
and you can learn about
Mm-hmm.
You can learn about history and tolerance, even if you can't sing or you don't know how to read music. You still get a whole lot through music.
I believe music's for everybody.
Amen.
And don't you feel that way? It's just like it's good for everybody.
Well, look, Jana, you know, Sarah, if you have a heart, you're a percussionist. It beats. It keeps
a
rhythm.
Right. And that's a good way to put that, Brian.
Well,
if your heart's beating, you're a percussionist.
I've done these songwriter showcases on different NPR affiliates and stuff. And in my mind, and I love songwriters. God love them. It's an art. It's a calling. But I believe that everybody has a song to sing.
I do too.
And maybe they only have one. But, you know, the idea that you can't be a musician... If you got a heart, you're already a musician. So
I couldn't agree more. And I think that everybody can be involved in the arts in different ways. And you don't have to be a Beethoven. You know, you can be on a lot of different levels and still be enjoying the gift of music.
And where are you headed in July? You have
I'm going to Venice, Italy. My husband and I are presenting in it's called the International Conference on Arts and Culture. And I was sent this invitation to apply, and I told a friend of mine, I said, nobody's going to pick up on cowboy music in Venice, Italy. And he said, well, you just never know. So I turned it in with my husband's going to be talking about the economic impact of the cattle industry as it grew in Kansas. And I'm talking about the trail drives and the music that came with it that the cowboys sang.
Incredible industries, both of them, feeding each other.
Yeah, and we were invited, so we're thrilled. On July 29th, we'll be in Venice talking about cowboys.
I can't think of a better person to be doing it. I mean, that's
cool. Funny. Somebody from New Mexico called me, and they said, we understand you're an expert on cowboy music. And when somebody tells me that, and Brian, you said that, I always want to go, am I really? You know, I don't know if I am or not, but I told them I've done a lot of reading in it and studying it. But New Mexico has adopted a cowboy state song.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They think they're the only state that had, a lot of states have state songs, but they actually have adopted a cowboy state song, and it's under New Mexico skies. And then our state
How's it go?
Oh, I have no idea, Brian.
I'm going to look it up, Jana.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. Our state song is Home on the Range.
Oh, yeah.
And that is often called the Cowboy National Anthem. And it was written in Kansas by a guy named Brewster Higley. And to me, there's just no more beautiful cowboy song than Home on the Range, and they would have been singing it on the trail drives.
His name again was Brewster?
Brewster Higley.
Brewster Higley.
And there's something that goes on in this area of Kansas, and this year was our fourth year, and it's called the Symphony in the Flint Hills. And the Kansas Symphony comes out, Kansas City Symphony, on a ranch, and each year it's on a different ranch, and they set up these big tents, and about, I don't know, 5,000 to 7,000 people go out and listen to Kansas City Symphony play, and it is so beautiful. You're on this prairie and they have books that talk about the history of the land, and the end of it, the symphony plays this beautiful arrangement of Home on the Range, and everybody stands and sings, and it's just so moving. And there's cowboys on horseback, Brian, you'd love it, and there's cattle that come up, and it's just a real part of the heartland of America, and it's a very special time. But we all sing Home on the Range, our state song.
One thing that I think about what you're doing, Jana, is my personal belief as a human being is that the future is the past, and the beauty of folk music is it's a It's a handed down tradition, very much like the Homeric epics were handed down.
That's true.
My hope is that people continue to do this.
And there's an appreciation more than ever now to not allow it to skip a generation, for sure, and to celebrate and live through and bring back some of the...
There's been some real interesting research by a gal from Florida, and her name's Dr. Marilyn Ward, and she did research on American folk music, and she learned that we are losing it in our schools. And I love her research. It's just so interesting. But she and I both believe that folk music is really part of who we are. It's our culture. And that it's very important that we not lose it. And I'm proud that Kansas and Nebraska both still are very strong in teaching folk music in their schools. So I hope more and more schools will continue to do it, because it is a part of who we are.
Absolutely. And speaking of schools and resources, we actually have a call-in question, believe it or not.
Cool.
And the question is, do computers interface or help with the with collecting the knowledge of this type of music in America? And I know that the Library of Congress has...
day or two at the Library of Congress, and oh my gosh, I had
and
fun.
Alan Lomax. Yeah. He basically built the folk, the Library of the Folk Songs. Is that would you say that
he
was
realized? He grew up, I think it was Corsicana, Texas. It was near there, and he actually remembered as a child hearing cowboys sing as they'd go by with the cattle, which is an incredible gift. Of course, that was, you know, turn of the 20th century, 19th to 20th century. And he realized, or it was earlier than that, but he realized that we were losing the cowboy music genre. And so he, in the early part of the 20th century, started collecting. And I'm just so thankful he did it, because no telling where we'd be if he hadn't done that. And kind of a little something interesting, they were collecting all these songs, and they decided to clean them up. A lot of them are bawdy. You can imagine a bunch of guys, you know, going 3 months on horseback driving cattle. And so there's a lot of verses that are really quite raunchy.
Are you serious?
Lomax and decided that because women, ladies, might be reading these books, that they would clean it up, and they did. But and now we wouldn't do that.
His grandfather who wrote the cowboy songs? I mean, it was a seminal 1910.
Yeah. Alan and the dad and the son, they both collected.
And so the point is that the Library of Congress has obviously an intense website.
And the Smithsonian has a nice collection. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that they saw the impact of it and were willing to collect it. And there's a wonderful museum in Duncan, Oklahoma. It's the Museum of the Chisholm Trail, and I would never have even known it was there. My husband was in Duncan doing some work with Halliburton and found it, and it's this beautiful place that has a great film about the history of the Chisholm Trail, and they have a wonderful interactive music part and a delightful collection of Western art, and it's just a very interesting place. I highly recommend it to people.
Right.
And then
Oklahoma.
The Cowboy Museum in Oklahoma City is really lovely, huge collection of all sorts of saddles that are just artworks.
Yes.
Even that one collection would be worth seeing. But they have many pieces of art, and all about the Hollywood and the cowboy tradition. And it's a great museum too.
One of my progenitors at the Hearst Corporation in this land and livestock division was Jack Cook, who's a member of the Cowboy Hall of Fame.
What did he have to do to
get that?
Well, I think he was a hell of a cowboy.
Yeah, probably be a fine cowboy.
Yeah, he was a good... And actually, Janet, if you could, if you feel up to talking about it, could you tell us, in the traditional sense, what a good cowboy is And I'm a man that lives by the cowboy code, but I'm not, you know.
Well, they were ethical. And, you know, there's still books. This is very interesting to me, too. There are still people writing about cowboy and their ethics. Ben Stein has a book out that's about 3 years old, and it's about living life with bunkhouse logic. And it's the idea that, like, your word is your bond,
right,
and that if you say something, you're going to do it, and that you don't cheat. The cowboys, I told Sarah this the other day, when they were on the trail, they ate mainly beans and whatever the cook, you know, beans and cornbread kind of thing, beans and biscuits, and they didn't eat all that much meat, which you would think, well, my gosh, they've got 1,000 cattle. Why don't they kill one?
Because they're not killing them.
And it didn't belong to them.
That's right.
That meat belonged to somebody else.
Right.
And the only time they would do it was if there was an injured cow, you know, or something like that, and then they would do it. But the cow did not belong to them. It belonged to someone else, and they were transporting it. So there was an ethic in there and an honesty in what they did. And of course, they were very skilled. You know, they could ride like crazy, and they cared for their animals.
And they were leaders. I mean, they basically
they were on their own. Oh, my gosh.
They had precious cargo, and they were responsible.
And they'd take off, you know, for the, and a lot of them were so young. I've got some great pictures. I've done a DVD of this information, and I use it educationally because I can't figure out how to market it because I've got a lot of pictures from historical places, and I don't know. There's a man at K-State trying to help me market it because there's interest, and a lot of people like to know the history.
The truth, Jana, is its own marketing tool.
Well, that is true. That is true.
Brian, you said
so many of the pictures, I'm just amazed at how young they were, the cowboys. They're 14, 16 years old. And
it's a hard life, and I think, I mean, the beauty to me, I guess I'm more of a spreadsheet cowboy.
Yeah.
I'm more responsible for profit and loss and
sure,
that kind of not so much fun stuff. But the beauty to me of the culture is, you know, that a good cowboy lets the cattle be cattle.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, it's a low-stress environment for the cattle. It's a smart way to manage animals.
And for the cowboy, it's contemplative.
It's a very contemplative, because you look at, you know, sitting on a saddle, which is not something I do much, but having done it a bit, it's a different view. And you look at a large group of animals, and the thing that I find beautiful about the cowboy culture is the idea that, you know, we're here to kind of push them to where they need to go and let them lead us.
Yeah. You know what? You're making me think of something. J. Frank Dobie, who was a big historian from Texas, was interviewing Charles Goodnight, which is he's the one that the Goodnight Loving Trail is named for. And he was an old man at the time, and he didn't want to talk about himself. He wanted to talk about the lead cow that he had, who was named Old Blue, and how much he respected that cow.
Yeah.
And that cow would lead these trail drives by himself. And he had a bell. And at night, he didn't want to lie down with the cattle. He'd kind of get near the cowboys because he really considered himself more of one of the people instead of one of the animals. And that he would lead these thousands of cattle up and back and then go back and do another one. And Charles Goodnight was so impressed with that animal. And there's so many stories about it. I sincerely hope we don't lose this tradition. And it was a huge part of the economy and the culture. There were so many Longhorn cattle in Texas after the Civil War. They were prolific. And the guys had gone off to fight the war, and they just let the cattle go. And Longhorns are really robust. They can live through hard times. And so they were prolific and not worth very much. And the men come home from the Civil War, and here are all these Longhorns. They're worth like $2 or $3 a piece, maybe. And they were used mainly for tallow and the hides. And then somebody realized hey, America wants to eat beef.
Right.
And so if we could just get them to the railheads, there's a profit because they were worth like $40 instead of three or four. So that's what started the trail drives, was the economy and the desire of Americans to eat beef.
Well, the old way of transportation.
I was thinking, Jana, you know, as an expert in this area, although you might not want to describe yourself as such.
I am. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, you are, so we'll just accept that. Do you have a favorite song that you feel is emblematic of cowboy culture in America?
I am drawn to Home on the Range. It's just so beautiful to me. I love that. But there's so many. The old Chisholm Trail is actually about the Chisholm Trail, and there are hundreds of verses because the cowboys would make them up as they went along, and it tells the story of the trail, and I love that, too.
And beyond the coincidence that it's Kansas, all of that Whoopi
Tai-Yi-Yo stuff, you know, that we hear, they really, that's from, some people call that the cowboy prayer because that's what they'd use to, whoop, whoop, you know, like that to get them going, and they work that into the music. And
Jana, do you play music, sing, or play an instrument?
My real performance area is piano, but I do play some guitar. But it's so many guys. You know, I wish I could travel around with you, Brian, because to have a male voice is really more the cowboy. Although, Brian, you sound too good.
A lot of the cowboys
were rough.
I'm blushing, Jana, but I'll sing for you anytime. You tell me where to be.
Good. You'll have to come to K-State. It was a rough sound a lot of times, just old guy on a horse, you know, and the singing. And it wouldn't have been this polished, beautiful sound. I do want to put a plug for Michael Martin Murphy because he keeps the old songs around. And he has played with Fort Worth Symphony and the San Antonio Symphony. And he really does keep the old music around. And there's one more before we leave this topic. There's a song called The Zebra Dun, and it's about a cowboy breaking a horse and how they thought he this wild horse, and this cowboy is going to be kind of a dandy, and they thought, oh, we'll get him on this horse, but it turns out he really could ride him. But it was called The Zebra Dun, which is so weird because where did a zebra come from?
Well, we have them at the Hearst Ranch, Jen.
Do you have zebras?
Yeah, a bunch of them.
Well, they think that the name really came from the Z-Bar Ranch, which is in Cottonwood Falls in Kansas.
That's great.
And that orally, you know, it kept going down to the Z-Bar, until finally zebra, and that's how it started. But I'm glad you have zebras.
Well, there was a movement in the 20s to bring on exotic animals into the United States, and that was how W.R. Hearst ended up bringing zebras into California.
Well, I know there's some camels that came in, you know, maybe that same movement that there was. There's some camels here in Kansas, and I know there were some in Texas, too.
Well, Jana, when you get back from Italy and the conference, we'd love to have you back on. I feel blessed having the best of two worlds, Brian Kenny from Hearst Ranch in California, Jana Fallon, professor of music, and a dynamite expert in cowboy music. So we will leave with a song from Brian. And Jana, thanks so much for sharing your heart and your stories. What a great history. Everyone, see you next week at 7 p.m. or on the web anytime. This is Eat to the Beat. I'm Sarah Obritis. We're on Heritage Radio Network, and we are sponsored by TechServe. And we are also at heritageradionetwork.com. Check us out, and thank you, everyone. Take it away.
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play. where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Ow! Seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Yodelay-o, yay-dee-ay, yodelay-o.